The DePaul Blue Demons feed off the roar of the crowd. And now that incredible home court advantage extends to you because the brand new Wintrust Arena is opening right in the heart of downtown Chicago. Get sensational seats to our back-to-work brand of basketball and bring your family and friends for hoops, hoopla, and all the other action-packed action. The new Wintrust Arena, home to your Blue Demons. It's Sweet Home Court, Chicago. It's Big East basketball in downtown Chicago as DePaul debuts in the city's newest entertainment venue, Wintrust Arena. For tickets, visit DePaulBlueDemons.com.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Charles Mudd on Startup Radio. Today is August 6th, and regrettably, we must reschedule once more the aired or the intended program with Chelsea Bingham of Wisely. That will be next week, August 13th. Chelsea Bingham of Wisely talking about fashion, startups, entrepreneurs, the startup scene in New York, and much, much more. So, for those of you that were anticipating, as I was, the conversation with Chelsea Bingham of Wisely, please do return on Monday, August 13th. In lieu of Chelsea's live interview today, we are going to re-air what has, for some, become a very favorite program, although there are many to choose from on StartupRadio.com. We are going to re-air the interview with Meg Hirschberg. But before I do, I'd like to once more thank Diana Rain for the use of the music for our program, and also to invite you to follow Startup Radio on Facebook facebook.com/startupradio, as well as Twitter on Startup Radio. That's at on Startup Radio for Twitter. Without further efforts, I'd like to once again replay the broadcast with Meg Hirschberg discussing the work-life balance among founders, their spouses, and families. I wish you well. Have a great afternoon and enjoy the program.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. Today is July 30th, Monday at 3 p.m. Central, and you're listening to Startup Radio. This is Charles Mudd, and I have the great pleasure of having with me today Meg Hirschberg. Meg has a bachelor's degree from Brown University in comparative literature and a master's from Cornell from its agriculture school. She is a columnist for Inc. magazine with her column Balancing Act, and she is also the author of the book For Better or For Work, a survival guide for entrepreneurs and their families, which we'll be talking much about today. And that book was selected by CNBC.com as one of the 12 most anticipated business books of 2012. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and I will admit that it's probably the second ebook that I've had the pleasure of reading, so you could also obtain it through the iBooks with Apple. Meg, welcome to Startup Radio, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Charles. Nice to be with you.
So, obviously, there's a lot to where the source of the book came from. But, you know, basically I understand that you became a columnist with Inc. magazine out of the response to your September 2008 article, Hitched to Someone Else's Dream. What prompted you to write that article?
You know, it was almost, it was really a lark, actually. I had been a freelance writer for about 10 years, and I had never written anything personal. I had written just regular nonfiction features for magazines. And but I, you know, I had always been telling my friends about the early years of our company, Stonyfield Yogurt, from my perspective, what it was like to live with a startup. And some of the stories, I mean, our startup experience was somewhat extreme in that we were not profitable for 9 years. We were on living on a farm under pretty difficult conditions physically, and financially things were very precarious. So friends encouraged me. They said, you should write about it. You should write about it. And I'd never written anything personal, but just for fun, I wrote a short piece about it for the Boston Globe magazine. And Inc. saw it and said, gee, could you blow this out to a full-length feature for our magazine, which I did. And it just knocked loose such an avalanche of mail. They were snowed by mail. And at that which point, the editor-in-chief called me and said, I think you're on to something important here that no one else is really talking about. So how would you feel about doing a regular column? So that's kind of how it got started. By mistake.
By mistake. Well, what were the responses like to the article? Were you surprised by the reaction that it obtained?
I was stunned. I mean, I'd never gotten a response like that before to anything that I had written in either intensity or quantity. I don't remember how many letters I got, but it was a ton. And I would say that the common themes were, first of all, many of them were quite detailed about people's experiences, almost as if they felt like they had permission for the first time to really talk about their experience. Most of these letters were from entrepreneurs, actually. Many were from spouses as well. So there was this kind of intensity to their responses. And in terms of the themes, I would say that many of them were along the lines of, I'm so glad to know that I'm not alone, that I'm not the only one. You know, I thought we were screwing up in our own particular way, and everybody else seemed to have this stuff together. So I think there was a lot of relief around that.
Well, I think it's interesting, and that would have been one of the thoughts that I would have had is, well, you know, I've heard that the startup process, being an entrepreneur, is not easy. And for my own business, my law practice, I certainly understand that. But you often do think, am I the only one? Are we the only couple going through this process? And on the other hand, I will have to say that, you know, part of it is maybe it's not, maybe it's recognition to be able to show the spouse that we're not alone and that we're all dealing with these pressures and the stresses. Because from what I've read in the book and so forth, they were quite immense at the yogurt farm. Is that correct?
I'm sorry, they were quite what?
The pressures and the strain were quite immense at the yogurt farm at times.
Yes, absolutely. If there's a bell curve of startups, we were way on the far end of that. I mean, just that we survived 9 years without making a profit, you know, under very, very difficult circumstances, until we actually got off the farm and were into a bona fide manufacturing facility. So to have year after year after year of bad financial news, and then there was the strain of having friends and family as investors. We had almost 300 investors in our company over all those years, and my mother was actually the largest outside investor, so that put a lot of pressure on us as well. And I do write about that, about the, you know, not saying that entrepreneurs should not take money from friends and family, but you must be very careful because it changes relationships, sometimes forever. And there are ways to counteract that. You know, there are ways to ensure, not 100% guaranteed that there won't be changes, but to ensure less misunderstanding among friends.
Yeah, that's an interesting topic that maybe we can spend a few minutes on, because it's related to, I guess, the term of art and some of the startup community might be bootstrapping rather than necessarily going and finding unrelated investors or startup capital. It's looking at friends and family and yourselves to obtain the funding for that. And that, as you mentioned, is in the book in Chapter 2. But how did that go for you and Gary and then the partners that you had? I mean, did you find that any of those investors ever came to you and overtly put pressure on, or was it more a perceived pressure because you don't want to disappoint the family and friends that have stepped up and, you know, are believing in what you're doing?
Well, we did have an investor sue us, actually, because she wanted to bring some, as the company continues to do poorly, she wanted to bring in some quote-unquote professional management. And she found some sort of little glitch in her perceived glitch. She ended up losing the case in her shareholder agreement, and she decided to use that as leverage to sue the company and get a change of management. So, you know, we did have issues that arose in terms of, she wasn't actually obviously a friend or a family member, but in terms of friends and family, you know, it just gets tough because you're sitting around the Thanksgiving table and it becomes more of a board meeting. You know, it's like past the quarterlies with the cranberries, you know, and you're talking about the business a lot. And family, you know, they want to be supportive, but they get anxious about the fate of their cash, very reasonably. I think that, you know, a lot of times money from those you love is the only money that an entrepreneur can get hold of during those early years. I mean, banks aren't interested in investing often, and VCs aren't interested. So you do turn to the people you love, and everyone is excited about it, and they want to be part of this new thing, and but, you know, they're investing in the product, sure, but first and foremost, they're investing in you, the entrepreneur. So you carry around the weight of that, the burden of that, their belief in you, and those are the last people you want to let down.
And it relates to something in your book that you mentioned about, you know, communication with the spouse and balancing how much information do you share. How much information do you share with your family members that have invested? It almost, if you're not doing well, it may become that you know, start to avoid or certainly aren't looking forward to those situations where the conversations may ultimately arise.
Well, that's it. You know, you don't want to start avoiding Thanksgiving dinner with the family. That's for
right. Sure.
You know, that would be a very bad outcome. I think it's different, though, with the spouse versus with investors, because you owe your investors complete transparency. You really do. You know, I mean, and whether they're family members or strangers, you owe them transparency with what's going on with your business. With your spouse, it gets a little more dicey because that's really a conversation that needs to happen. I mean, we had so many bad years, year after year, that after a while, I was so stressed out about our bad, you know, the bad balance sheet, for the spouse, you've got to remember the spouse is relatively powerless. Unless the spouse works in the business, the spouse has no say over what goes on in the business. And so, on the one hand, he or she is very much subject to the fortunes of the business, but on the other hand, there's nothing they can do to affect the outcome. So, you know, you combine those two things, and it can make for, you know, a very explosive mix. So I think that the spouses need to have an open and honest conversation about how much do you want to know? You know, we got to the point in our business where I just turned to Gary and I said, you know what, I can't hear all this bad news anymore. It's too stressful for me. There's nothing I can do about it. So we would just kind of tailor what we talk about. We would discuss things like new products, new accounts. You know, he shielded me from some of the worst news. And that, you know, that's not an ideal outcome. I mean, ideally spouses can really share everything, but it was the best we could do at the time given our circumstances.
And it sounds like from what you just described that that was a mutually agreed upon approach to making it survivable for both of you. Is that correct?
Yeah, I would definitely say that because, you know, the last thing Gary needed was after a tough day of dealing with, you know, lost spoiled yogurt or, you know, suing shareholders, the last thing he needed was my alarm bells going off at the end of the day. So, you know, we kind of patched it together for a while. Like I say, it wasn't ideal because as spouses, you want to share things that are happening for you that are important to you. And this kind of forced us to shoulder our respective burdens alone, which is not a good scenario, but it was, again, the best we could do under the circumstances. I don't think it's a good long-term solution.
Well, sure, and I can speak from my own circumstance, and I'm actually going to follow the recommendation of one of your 20 simple rules and recognizing the value that Catherine, my wife, puts into the success of, you know, the law firm that I have and the business that we've grown to where we have employees, associates, and so forth. I wouldn't be able to do it without her. And there are certainly times where, there are stresses going on at work with the business that you have no one else you can talk to at the business about those particular stresses. And so you do want to come home and be able to have somebody to share them with. But at the same time, to the extent that, you know, they create added pressure on top of the pressures that the spouse is having and just putting the meals together and picking up the kids or doing whatever the share of those familial responsibilities are, it really is a balance. But whatever the balance one comes away with, what I'm getting from you is that communication and making those decisions is the most important. So that where you and Gary may have come to that decision yourself, it was after talking about it. It's not that the spouse...
It wasn't unilateral.
Or, right. Exactly.
Right, and I agree with that. That would not be a good situation which is actually usually the situation where one spouse, the entrepreneur, say, you know, starts to clam up and just, you know, put a rosy cast on things because he or she just doesn't want to deal with the response. And I think that can get to be very unhealthy. Much better to talk about it openly.
Now, there are a couple other chapters that I'd like to touch on, and there are 15 total chapters in the book, and they're all extremely relevant topics, and I could talk about my own experiences, but I don't want to dwell on myself. I want you to be able to provide your insight to the listeners that we have now and those that will listen to the program later on Startup Radio. But in Chapter 6, talking about children and the impact that it has on children, because we were just talking about the balance between spousal obligations and so forth and sharing that information, but then also balancing the time. And that is like the ultimate work-life balance, I think, is when you have children. The spouse is an adult, you know, their responsibilities definitely going to take up another rule that you have is, I think, you know, finding the time to just get out and do something with your spouse, whatever it happens to be. But the kids, where do you find the people that you've talked to? What are the problems that they've come up with or experienced with children, and how do they address those?
Well, I think the problem of working parents and guilt is universal, whether or not you're a CEO. And there are studies that show that most people feel guilty, that they're not giving the amount of time or attention to their children that they think is ideal. I think it's exacerbated for CEOs because there's a lot of travel involved when you own your own business, frequently, most of the time, actually, sales meetings and so forth. And also, there's the financial risk that you are placing on your, you know, beloved progeny without their knowledge or consent, because often that's the case as well, that you're taking, you know, the entrepreneur takes a risk for the entire family. And then there's the issue of distraction, that even when you're, you know, sitting on the floor with Junior reading, you know, the little engine that could, you're thinking about your, you really need to get on email and deal with some crisis or other, or work trails you on vacation, nights, weekends. So I think entrepreneurs have a particular kind of guilt when it comes to children. But, you know, I interviewed, and I should pause here to say that for the book itself, I interviewed about 250 entrepreneurs and spouses. So it's not just my own experience. I really got so much wisdom and insight from the people I interviewed. And they came up with a number of strategies and solutions that they use to make them feel better about work and parenting altogether, and how, you know, how to, what kind of mix is appropriate for their family. And I'd encourage your listeners to read my book and read that chapter in particular to learn about some of the strategies employed by these very hardworking CEOs when it comes to, you know, balancing their family life. I mean, there's no one-size-fits-all answer for all CEOs, and it really does depend on also the age of your children and their particular needs. But there are some strategies that parents can use, certainly. One example is the family meeting. I interviewed several people who have regular meetings with their families, even with young kids, as young as like 5 and 6. And they'll have these regular sit-downs where they talk about how things are going and ways not only that the kids can do a better job in helping to reduce the tension in the household and make it function better, but they ask for feedback from their kids about things that they can do differently also as parents. And this one guy I interviewed said his kid came back to him and said, you know, you're just on your iPhone too much. It's too much. And he started putting limits. And that's another thing that I definitely recommend is placing it. They can be small but specific limits on technology. For example, during the dinner hour, I think it's really important to not bring the smartphone, you know, that nobody in the family be allowed to bring their electronic toy to the dinner table.
And sometimes or that that's what it does end up being, right, an electronic toy for even the adults.
Absolutely. And even if it's sitting there, I mean, and I've discovered this in my own experience, even if it's just sitting there, if it's off but sitting on the table, it exerts this kind of power over everybody. You keep kind of looking at it and waiting for it to blink or it buzzes when a text message comes in. You know, just keep it away from the family dinner table. I really strongly urge people, even if it's only for an hour, you know, I think that little things go a long way when it comes to family life and with children specifically.
You know, and it just occurred to me that that might be a way to compromise with the children as well when they complain that they want to be playing with the DS or whatever the toy of the day happens to be, is making the compromise that dad and mom are also sacrificing by not having their phones or their devices at the dinner table. And it's a time just for everybody to focus on each other and what they've done. And, you know, I have to add one anecdote related to that, and it was a completely unintentional experience. We, Catherine and I, went to Las Vegas. There was supposed to be a conference, but the conference ended up being canceled. So I said, well, let's just go. And of course, I take my laptop wherever I go. But what I did not take unintentionally was the power cord. And so, as it turns out, I was limited to about 2.5 to 3 hours of work time. And for the rest of the time, it was really, there was no way to do any work. And it was one of the best vacations that we had in a long time.
Yes, We all need those kinds of accidents. Maybe it wasn't so accidental after all.
Yeah. Well, that may be true, too. And it's interesting, your comments in the book talking about vacations, that you've got to take those vacations, right? You have to take those times to get away. Would you agree with that?
You know, I make, in my book and in my talks to entrepreneurs and executives, I make a very big deal about vacations because I think they are so easy to sacrifice. Just sacrifice, period, or when you're on vacation to essentially be working, carry your work with you. And I'll tell you that this is my own experience and so many people who I've interviewed. Vacations saved Gary and me. I mean, our lives were so crazy for so long that we look forward to them for months, and then we enjoyed them so much, and we savored the memory for so long, and it really helped keep our marriage and our family life stitched together during, you know, really difficult and demanding times. Again, you know, my motto is it doesn't take much. You don't have to take a two-week, you know, African safari or something. It doesn't have to be expensive. It doesn't have to be far away, but you do need to take those times and get out of your everyday routine and hopefully learn something new, go someplace new. Again, you don't need to spend a lot of money. It could be going on a camping trip, but just a change of venue, a change of pace, and a time when the family is all together in a dedicated way. Now, you know, for Gary and me, often these vacations, he would have to work mornings. He'd have to be in touch, get some stuff out. So, well, I'd say mornings, because at first he started working at various times during the day, and that just didn't feel good because we didn't have, like, big, reliable blocks of time together. So then he wound up just working mornings. That was our compromise. And then we'd have all afternoon and evening together as a family, and that just worked out great.
Hmm.
So I think there are compromises to be made within that, but vacations are essential from what I have learned from my own experience and, again, from those I've spoken to.
Talking about those that you've spoken to, and again, and it's amazing that, you know, 250 about entrepreneurs and spouses that you interviewed for the book, what are the highlights of what you've actually learned from them?
Boy, every single conversation, every time I hung up the phone, I would think to myself, wow, that was fascinating. I mean, I didn't include 250 voices in the book, but everyone I interviewed, because obviously it's too many, you know, I really just took the stories and examples that were most instructive, I thought, to most entrepreneurs. But I learned something from everyone I spoke with. I took away so much of value. I mean, it really, I continue to do it for my Ink column, and I just continue to learn so much from people. When you actually stop and listen and ask the right questions, it's amazing just how thoughtful and reflective people can be. And I think entrepreneurs as a group are, you know, smart and interesting and thoughtful people when asked. You know, normally they're just so busy trying to get things done that they don't take the time to express. And actually that leads me to another important point, I think, about all this, which is that the reason that you don't see columns like mine. I mean, it's or books like mine. I mean, it's astonishing to me that given how prevalent these issues are, that there's not more discussion going on around them. And I think the reason for that is that, you know, and we were the same way for the first many, many years of our businesses. I think entrepreneurs feel they have to be very stoic, you know, that when asked how is your business going, no matter what is going on, there are two permissible answers. It's going, you know, well, or it's going great, you know.
Right, right.
And, you know, people don't feel that they're afraid of the effect on whether it's suppliers or employees or investors. of, you know, what's going to be the effect on them if you start saying, you know, gee, I don't know, things aren't going well, I'm having some trouble at home, there's a lot of stress, you know, that feels like it would be death for the business. And so I think that's why entrepreneurs don't tend to talk about this stuff. And yet it's very, very commonplace in entrepreneurial families.
Well, but it still surprises me that there hasn't been a book like yours and a column like yours or more of them, because, you know, the column and the book are something that it's not like you have to communicate or share your doubts or so forth with many people. It's, you know, you can read the book in the privacy of one's own home, if not the office, and get that insight and realize, just from the article that you wrote, and then that led to the column in the book, is that you're not alone and that there are other people out there. And that leads me to one point that you also mention in the book, and that is finding not so much a mentor, but finding somebody else that has experience, maybe more experience in terms of years in being an entrepreneur or running a business, so that you can have somebody that you can talk to that's a friend, somebody that you can all share, both the entrepreneur and the spouse. Do you find that the people that you've spoken to, is that something that many of them were doing?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I've interviewed a lot of people who are members of EO, Entrepreneurs Organization, and like organizations. And while they're really grateful for the educational opportunities they get by being members and the seminars and so forth, they seem to be most thrilled about being put in touch with other entrepreneurs who they can actually let their hair down with, speak honestly about all kinds of issues, business and personal. And I think people really need that. I know that for our first decade or so in business, we really didn't know other business people. And I think a lot of people don't have friends who are business people necessarily, unless they join these groups and meet others. So, you know, most of my friends had regular jobs. They had paid vacations. They had regular salaries so they could start buying homes and having, like, you know, predictable income. And, you know, I was desperate for a mortgage, believe it or not. I mean, I wanted to own a home so badly.
You wanted a thermostat.
I wanted a thermostat, right, because we were living on the farm, which was, you know, wood heated. I pined for thermostats. And I would, you know, I would look around at all of them, and they seemed to be getting on with their lives and, you know, going through the normal steps that people go through and buying homes and having children, getting settled in the community. And I look at them and think, man, did Gary and I screw up? Like, I don't know how we, you know, I don't know how we went so wrong here. Because you feel very alone when you're, you know, I think that when you're trying to do something as demanding as is starting a business and making it flourish, it can be a very isolating experience. So I absolutely think it's important, however you do it, to connect with others who are also trying. They don't have to be in your industry, just to live with some of the same stressors that you do in terms of the risks that you're taking, the distractions that you have, and, you know, inability to devote the kind of family time that you all want to, the spouse's doubts. You know, I talk a lot about that in the book, when spouses start doubting the enterprise. I mean, that's really difficult for the entrepreneur. I mean, I lived in a state of chronic doubt about our business. So, you know, Gary had to learn to live with that and talk to me about it. So, you know, these are things that are threads that run throughout the entrepreneurial experience.
Because as you explain in the book, oftentimes the doubts about the business can be perceived incorrectly at many times, I would presume, as a doubt about the entrepreneur or the person, the spouse, and they really are two different things, right?
Well, they are. I mean, you know, I think that it becomes very delicate for the spouse to express any doubts about the business, because entrepreneurs are so identified with their businesses that any kind of questioning about the validity or the future potential of the business starts to feel like questioning the entrepreneur. Like you're doubting my idea, you're doubting my ability to execute on my idea. You know, it's very hard, if not impossible, to separate the two. And certainly if the business does not do well, and remember 50% of businesses go under in the first 5 years, then the family, there's a lot of risks in that, and I devote a chapter to this, you know, a loss of business and how that affects families, because the entrepreneur and the spouse have to be very careful if they do lose the business to not let it toxify their relationship, and that becomes very tricky as well.
You know,
so let me. I just want to pause for a minute to say that a lot of things that we're talking about sound dark, dire, and difficult. But globally, when I step back and look at the whole thing, our experience in owning a business and my husband's running the business and living with a business for 30 years has been extremely positive. It's been great for our family. It's been wonderful for our children. They've learned about business. They've gotten this kind of economic literacy that a lot of their friends don't have. They understand how products are dreamed up and marketed and produced and things like that that their friends have no clue about. So it's been a tremendous experience for us. And the reason that I wrote the book is I think it can be more of a positive experience for more people if they have a heads up about some of the issues that they are likely to confront and some guidance about some solutions that they might use to overcome these problems when they arise. So that's really my goal, is never to discourage entrepreneurship, because I think it's fantastic and can be a great family experience, but just to be wary and be prepared.
And I think that definitely comes across from the book, and hopefully from this conversation as well, people will gather that, and now that you've just said it, I have no doubt they will, because that's clearly coming across from the book. And the way that I read the book is this is a resource to help entrepreneurs manage through some of the issues that they may come across, some of what might be some dark times, so that you get to the positive times and to learn that other people have done it too. I mean, so I'm glad you pointed that out, because certainly that's what, you know, I wanted this conversation to be, is talking about how entrepreneurs, CEOs, business owners can learn to help themselves through your book and the topics that you discuss. But your point also brings up an interesting distinction between those that are already entrepreneurs, whether they be in the first year or the 10th year or the 30th year, and those that are thinking about it. And from my experience, from just the people that I've talked to on Startup Radio and related matters, many of the people thinking about becoming an entrepreneur, thinking about a startup, have the idealized version of, wow, I'm going to be able to set my own hours, do what I want to do. And I think that your book will definitely help them as well. But do you agree that have you found that there's that distinction between those that are in it and didn't expect or even contemplate that there might be some issues, dark issues, or tough times that they might have to address, and then there are those that don't even contemplate it before they go in?
Well, I think that most entrepreneurs are aware when they start their businesses that they are taking a financial risk, but they chronically underestimate the personal risks that they're taking in terms of their relationship with their family and even their friends. And I think the reason for that is that there is so much, there's kind of, you know, not just stereotypes, but there's this kind of like romantic glow around entrepreneurship. It's really the American dream, and legitimately so. I mean, there's not many places in the world where you can just have an idea and get the funding and turn it into reality. Even westernized countries like France, we're pretty familiar with, you know, there are so many stumbling blocks, so much bureaucracy in terms of getting a business started, it's almost impossible. And this country really makes it possible for you to have a dream, have a vision, and, you know, boldly set forth and make it happen. And I think that is a beautiful thing. But because it's such a part of the American dream, there is this romantic glow around it, and people don't, you know, they often, when they're, you know, they're all full of their wonderful idea and how well it's going to work and it's going to sell a million of, you know, widgets, and they don't really stop to think, first of all, many of the business realities that they're going to be encountering, but also, of course, the personal realities until they're hit with it. So absolutely, that is a big purpose of my book is again, not to discourage, but to say, you know, here's a heads up of things that are very likely to affect you as you are getting your business going, and here are some strategies and solutions for you. But also, even beyond that, just to give entrepreneurs and spouses the vocabulary that they need. I mean, in the first many years of our business, I felt worried and anxious, but I didn't even know how to express that. Like, I didn't know what I didn't understand even what universe I was operating in, because I didn't know other business people. Like, is this normal for me to doubt this business? Like, is that okay? I mean, do other people feel that too? You know, I didn't know. And so I think just, again, providing the vocabulary and that freedom to discuss it, it's okay to talk about these things. It's not going to make your business or your personal life fall apart. In fact, the contrary, it will strengthen both.
Well, that's well said. And I think that, you know, the honesty that you're expressing here, it reflects that which comes forth in the book and the anecdotes and the insight from other people. It's just a fantastic resource. And moving to a positive chapter, although I will just mention that, you know, there are chapters in there on when a company fails or passing the reins, you know, an exit strategy, you know, where somebody gets sick. So there are, I mean, any countless issues that you address in the book. 15 extremely well done chapters. Now, the chapter 15, though, before we get to questions from those listening, those magic moments, what do you talk about in chapter 15?
Well, what I did for that chapter was I put out a call to my email list and to EO members and others for stories about positive experiences that their family members, not them, but that their family members had experienced as a result of being connected to a business. Because I wanted, you know, after all the tough things I talk about in the book, I wanted to end on a positive note. You know, I wanted to end the book reminding people about why they're doing this. What are the possible benefits to their families, that it's not all going to be drudgery and a drag for their family members. There's a lot of great upsides. So I got these fantastic vignettes back about really cool things that have happened to family members as a result of being connected to a business. So I included, they're each just a paragraph long. They're just little stories. But they were fun. They were fun to read, and a lot of people have commented on them because it's just, again, a reminder of all the upside.
And there is an upside. I mean, I'll second that, and that for whatever struggles and ongoing struggles I have with, you know, running the firm and having a business and so forth, the upside, you know, certainly has much more weight than the downside. And I think that chapter shows those anecdotes and the contributions from the people that you reached out to, including yourself at the end there, show that being in business for yourself, being an entrepreneur, can give the family members, as you've just said, so many opportunities, so many exciting opportunities that others may not have. And I think that drives home the point that you were making earlier, in that you are being positive. You know, you're not trying to discourage anything, but it's a wonderful resource that you've provided to those that are entrepreneurs now, those that may be thinking about that. And I, as we've kind of spoke about before the program began, I think that your book has a potential much wider audience, and that really many people in business, whether the CEO or not, whether people recognize that they're entrepreneurs or not, many people running a solo practice law firm or a small law firm would not necessarily recognize that they are entrepreneurs and business owners. And I would highly recommend to any of those your book. Now, I'd like to finish before we go to questions on two points. One, to talk, if you could just mention a little bit about the role reversal that you and Gary have had of late and what he's observed with you focusing on your book and getting it out to the populace, and your perception of what it may have been like for him in focusing, as you said, on your passion project.
Well, this was one of the wonderful, unexpected benefits of writing this book, was that we absolutely changed places, and we got to walk in the other person's shoes. It's not often that spouses get a chance to do that. And for Gary's part, you know, he was the one eating dinners alone while I was up.
Mark? Hello?
Lap right next to my bed and, you know, waking up at 5 in the morning with an idea for something. And so this is, of course, what I've been living with for, you know, almost 30 years. And, you know, likewise for me, it was a passion project for me. I was completely engrossed. I worked, you know, 7 days a week for a year with very few breaks. And because I loved what I was doing, it was fascinating. And, you know, of course, I had deadlines, you know, not to minimize the importance of deadlines, but I loved.
Who's this? Hello?
Sort of entrepreneurial, you know, just that joy of creation and of putting something into the world that's never been there before. I got my first real taste of that. So I think, you know, we've noted, Gary and I, since then, how much that's actually helped our relationship. I mean, of course, every chapter I wrote, he and I would discuss. So just even going through that was interesting for us, and tackling each issue and me asking him, well, what was that like for you back then when this was happening in the business? Or, you know, were you ever afraid of going bankrupt? You know, I mean, I would ask him a lot of questions. And I learned a lot about what he had been going through in the past. So, yeah, there were a lot of hugely wonderful benefits for our relationship as a result of writing this book. And I think there will be, you know, great benefits for, as in the end, Gary in his afterword recommends that both spouses read it. You know, they read it to each other, read it aloud, and discuss it together instead of one of, you know, either the entrepreneur or the spouse reading the book. Both should read it and use it as an opportunity to talk about these things. It helped us a lot.
Well, I am going to take you up on that suggestion. One final thing that I'd like to ask you about is that your husband, Gary, and his anecdotes mention all the many things that you have done and participated in. One of them is helping with a post-treatment program for cancer patients at the local hospital. Is that something that you're still involved in doing?
Oh, yes. I am neck deep in that. It's kind of a long story, but the bottom line is that it's a lifestyle transformation program that's 12 weeks long, that's based on a book that I read that really, I'm a cancer survivor, So this book really helped me change my life in a very healthy and optimistic and positive way. And so I approached my local hospital and said, I think we should start a program based on this book at the hospital. Well, that was about that was more than 2 years ago, and we are well underway. We've had two semesters worth of courses, and it's been a smashing success, and we're actually maybe working with LiveStrong and others to spread it nationwide. So it's really very exciting.
Fantastic. Meg, I've really enjoyed our conversation. I'm going to use the little time that we have left to get to a couple questions. But before I do, where can people find more about you? I understand that you have a blog and a website. What is that address?
So the address is meghirschberg.com. So it's M-E-G, like Meg, H-I-R-S-H-B-E-R-G.com. And on my website, I have a whole host of things. I have an interview series I did with entrepreneurs. I've got all my Inc. articles. I have a whole page devoted to my book, and I have a chapter there that you can read, and as well as the introduction table of contents to see what's actually in the book. I've got my speaking schedule and a whole host of other things. So if you're interested, if your audience is interested, that's where to go.
Well, we'll take our first question from Mark. Mark, please feel free to go ahead.
Hi, yes. I found the subject matter you're talking about very interesting. Not to get in the dire part, but I know you had alluded to, you know, what happens when, you know, the startup fails, given the stat that you had said that, you know, nearly half or more fail. What are the best ways to for a family to deal with that?
Well, again, I would refer you to my book because I do have some stories in there. It's really hard on a family, needless to say, especially when the spouse has been doubting the business all along, and then it becomes, you know, there's ample opportunity for either spouse to rip into the other one. You know, you didn't do everything you could have done, or you weren't as supportive as you could have been. I mean, it can really, the stress of a business failure can really tear a family apart. And I think it's important to, as one of the couples I interviewed did, to really reconnect with what got you together in the first place. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, there may be tremendous effect on the family, but at the end of the day, it's only a business,
mm-hmm.
You know, and it's important to try to disentangle yourselves from that. Now, that's, of course, easier said than done, and therapy is probably not a bad idea for people who believe in that and find that useful. But there are, you know, I do have some suggestions in the book about things that you can do, but it's certainly easy. I mean, you'll see, you know, I interviewed certainly a ton of couples whose relationship fell apart because of it. So it takes work, but it can be done. Absolutely. You can absolutely move past business failure. Many people have.
Right. I do have one follow-up question, which kind of, you know, obviously with a startup, you know, there are struggles that come on initially, and then, you know, obviously it will affect the family. Have you seen, like, from talking to these people, a correlation when they're able to overcome some of the stress and for lack of a better word, drama in the family situation? Do you see a correlation where then the business starts to pick up, or because just from my mind, like, if, you know, you can get your family back in track, you know, you get the added boost to you know, to improve on your startup. But is there a correlation, or?
I'm glad that you asked that question. I can't tell you a specific correlation. I didn't actually study that per se, but I will say that it's common knowledge, and I've interviewed, you know, professors at Harvard Business School and elsewhere, that if your personal life is in tatters, your business is going to suffer. And, you know, because you will be distracted, you will be enervated, you know, you won't have the energy and the focus that you need. You know, I mean, I'm generalizing, of course. I mean, certainly there are individuals who will. But for the most part, it is a real drain on the business, just to, you know, talk about it in just practical terms. So that's really another reason to, you know, read my book and make sure that you're aligned and things are somewhat peaceful at home, because your business will certainly suffer. And I can say that anecdotally, like I say, I haven't done any studies, but it will certainly suffer. I think it's common sense if you are distracted by a personal life that is really not functioning.
Thank you, Mark. Our next question will come from Stephanie. Stephanie, you feel free to go ahead.
Hi, Meg. Mine was more of a comment and less of a question. Just what we were talking about, what you, I suppose, were talking about earlier with the family meetings.
Yes.
When I was a kid, we had them all the time. And it was, you know, separate from dinner. It was, this is meeting time. And just from the kids' perspective, it's extremely helpful in terms of just general family peacekeeping. Because if you get an idea, and it was more so when I was like in my teens, you know, we're not having this meeting with a five-year-old, but knowing where my parents were at work and how they were feeling about work kind of gives my sister and I an idea of like, maybe we back off this week. You know, maybe I don't come to the dinner table saying I need $20 for a field trip right away. But
yeah,
it was really helpful in terms of just keeping the peace and knowing, you know, what's going on in our parents' lives when they're away from the house for so long.
Absolutely. It can only increase understanding and respect for what everyone is going through.
Right.
Even, you know, younger kids, what they're, you know, they are, or it's a great place for family grievances to come out and for kids to learn about problem solving. You know, Johnny wouldn't let me play with his friends. You know, I mean, these are, they, you know, you the kids start to learn that there are ways there to solve problems that don't just involve getting angry and storming off, or, you know, so I think on any number of levels, family meeting is a great idea. We didn't do it regularly in our household. I wish we had. We did it occasionally, usually when there was a pressing problem. But I don't think families should wait for a pressing problem. I think it should be routine. Absolutely. I think I really agree with what you say.
Thank you, Stephanie, for your comment and your contribution. Meg, it's been wonderful having you here. Meg Hirschberg, author, columnist, speaker, mother, and spouse, I want to thank you for your insights and talking about your book. And maybe, hopefully, we'll have you back on again to share more thoughts in the future. But thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me, Charles. Take care.
Thank you. You do the same. This has been Startup Radio. We are on today, July 30th, with Meg Hirschberg. We hope you've enjoyed the broadcast that you've just had. And next week, we will have Chelsea Bingham of Wisling. If you're interested in vintage clothing or just used pre-owned clothing, she has a new niche market online that I'd recommend you join us to hear more about. And then August 20th, Allison Sawyer from Rebellion Photonics. Very interesting discussion that we'll have then. Feel free to follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/startupradio, as well as on Twitter @onstartupradio. I want to again thank Meg Hirschberg for joining us today. It's been a fantastic conversation. I highly recommend the book, For Better or For Work. I would definitely go obtain it, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, or through the iBooks. It's been insightful for me, as has this conversation. Thank you again, Meg. Thank you, everybody, and enjoy the day. So long.
The DePaul Blue Demons feed off the roar of the crowd. And now that incredible home court advantage extends to you because the brand new Wintrust Arena is opening right in the heart of downtown Chicago. Get sensational seats to our back-to-work brand of basketball and bring your family and friends for hoops, hoopla, and all the other action-packed action. The new Wintrust Arena, home to your Blue Demons. It's Sweet Home Court, Chicago. It's Big East basketball in downtown Chicago as DePaul debuts in the city's newest entertainment venue, Wintrust Arena. For tickets, visit DePaulBlueDemons.com. The DePaul Blue Demons feed off the roar of the crowd. And now that incredible home court advantage extends to you because the brand new Wintrust Arena is opening right in the heart of downtown Chicago. Get sensational seats to our back-to-work brand of basketball and bring your family and friends for hoops, hoopla, and all the other action-packed action. The new Wintrust Arena, home to your Blue Demons. It's Sweet Home Court, Chicago. Bring the family and watch DePaul's men's and women's basketball team scrimmage at new Wintrust Arena. Free admission Saturday, October 14th. Visit DePaulBlueDemons.com for info.